Welcome to the Theatre Voice. I'm Judy Herman, and I am talking today to Nina Raine. We're in Nina Raine's flat in South London, and Nina is both a playwright and a director. So although we're here to talk about her production of Longing, I think we're probably going to range a bit further than that. So Nina, welcome to Theatre Voice, and thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to this.
Nina, I should really ask you, just because you are both a playwright and a director, and sometimes you're both together, like you were on Tiger Country, so do you have a preference at all for one or the other, or doing both together?
I love doing both, obviously. I find that if I take on too many directing jobs one after the other, I don't get any writing done, because it's so absorbing when you direct something. And so you have to, it's a balancing act, really. But it's not about liking one more than the other. Writing, obviously, is so solitary, and you can start to feel rather morose and self-conscious if you spend too much time on your own just gazing into your laptop screen. So directing is brilliant for jerking you out of that and having the excitement of a whole room full of people and their creative energies making something work, rather than just you trying to power the thing with your rather feeble dynamo, you know. And so it's a great thing to be able to alternate between the two. It's also, I mean, I didn't realise this, but I started off as an assistant director, and I didn't realise that it was going to be incredibly useful to me to be able to direct my own play, because it was so tough getting it actually on. If I hadn't been able to take matters into my own hands and direct it myself, I don't know whether it would ever have happened, you know. So it's a great sort of powerful thing to have that as an option, to direct something yourself. You know, for instance, my brother's written a play, and who knows whether any theatre will accept it, but I'm planning to direct it, maybe on the fringe if no one will do it. And you know, it's really liberating to feel that if all else fails, you can do it yourself, you know.
Now you're directing William Boyd's very first play, and because it's based on two Chekhov stories intertwined, of course we're looking at some sort of naturalism here, and I don't think Tiger Country was quite so naturalistic, was it?
Tiger Country, my play about the state of the NHS, it was quite jagged, it was quite sort of fractured, and you know, you jumped from one thing to another, and big scene with lots of people, two-hander. I suppose that in Longing, what you're maybe getting at is that Longing is much more legato in a way. You know, it's very obviously linear and all in one place and one kind of time frame, obviously, and all of that, yeah.
No, I mean, exactly that, and where there's no selective realism in it, is there? I mean, we come in and we know where we are. We're in one of those wonderful country estates in Chekhov. In Lizzie Clacken's absolutely beautiful set, but it's so detailed, and it needs to be, actually, to have that sense of place, whereas, you know, in a hospital, you don't need so much to suggest the bedroom where...
I think less is more. I mean, Lizzie worked on that hospital set with me as well, and Lizzie is a brilliant, brilliant designer, and her forte, I think, is the sort of the grubby naturalism, which she could go to town with on the set for Longing. And, I mean, I saw this show she did called Money, which was in London Bridge in a found space, and she had constructed this set encrusted with detail. You know, there was a bit where you looked in over the top of a sort of a house scene from above through a plate glass ceiling, and everything was there down to the doilies under the vases and everything. And she could do all that with this stature. And she loves to do that stuff, and I wasn't holding her back. Whereas on Tiger Country and Jumpy, which she also designed for me, I was continually paring it away and sort of slightly forcing her out of her comfort zone, which she was grateful for in the end, but it meant that it was maybe more of a tussle at moments.
Yeah, but that was right for those two plays, for Jumpy as well. You know, that selective realism, you don't need everything. But what is lovely is that you have that relationship with Lizzie, that you've worked together so often, and of course with Tamsin Gregg. But is that very, very special, that building up relationships, both with, you know, your creative team and with your performers?
Yes, I think it's wonderful when you discover someone that you can work with well, and it's lovely to know that they feel that you're getting the best out of them, you know, as well as you just thinking, well, hooray, they're wonderful, good, they're going to sort of help this work for all of us. And yes, Tamsin is amazing, because not only is she a hugely talented actress and can do so many things that people don't really realise, I think. They see her in Black Books or Green Wing and they can see that she's a genius comic, but she's also got these depths of pathos and also intelligence, you know. And I first sort of got to see those in Jumpy.
Of course, to me, having seen it, she just seems like a shoo-in for the part. And, of course, any comedy that there is there, and my goodness, there's so much wry comedy there, she is going to find. And you know, it's a bit of a cliche, the word tragicomedy, but this is a tragicomedy. And if anyone's going to mind that, it's going to be Tamsin. I don't know if you can remember the thing that she used to be in on the television called Love Soup. Wasn't a tragicomedy about not quite getting it together, I don't know what was. So, which is what this is. Really, I mean, at least her plot line is exactly that, isn't it?
Yes. And it never fails to amaze me. I mean, Max Stafford Clarke talks about the CP, the comic potential of a scene, and how some actors are like divining rods and they just can sense it where no one else would know there's a stream of it under the earth, you know. And Tamsin's a bit like that. But she never, ever sacrifices a scene to sort of make a laugh happen, you know. I suppose what I love about Tam is that, and it's partly to do with the way that she brings the humour out of things, is that she makes the scene and the character so human, you know. It's not grand, high, tragic style. It's warm and open and near to us. And also, it's very unvain, you know. She doesn't mind a little sort of that we laugh at the character in a moment, you know. She's fantastic. And actually, what I've been noticing now, I mean, since we're doing this interview, you know, partway through the run, is just how she manages to fine tune and find new things as she performs. And Tamsin has talked about how boredom is a terrible sort of enemy to have in the room or on the stage, that you can get rather bored when you found the perfect way to do a line. You think, well, she likened it to, you know, furniture in a room, and you think, well, maybe I'll try putting that chair over there instead. And it's not very good over there, but you've tried it at least, and you know, so you change things for the sake of it. But I haven't seen that happen at all. What I've seen with, I think, the other actors are sort of following her lead, is that they find new little moments of truth to plot in, you know. For instance, when someone is talking to someone else in a big scene with many people on stage, you know, I see Tam catch someone else's eye, not the person who's being spoken to, and she's not being spoken to, but they're having a reaction about what's just been said to someone else, you know. Little details like that are just really inspired and kind of heighten the beauty of the whole thing, you know.
So Longing, it's just the most brilliant title, because it is the elegiac, that idea of the tragicomedy being a cliche, but it so is that. I have never seen so many people yearning. It's almost like this one's yearning for that one, but that one's actually yearning for someone else. And that's really William Boyd, isn't it? Because he's woven them all together so that it's almost like a little chain.
Yes, it's like a one-way system, isn't it? Like Twelfth Night or something, where so and so A loves B, who loves C, who loves D, yes, and so on, ad infinitum.
Can we just give a resume of how William Boyd has brought together these two stories to sort of make a new Chekhov play, two Chekhov stories, one new Chekhov play, so cleverly?
Well, the two stories are A Visit to Friends and My Life. A Visit to Friends is really short. I think it's about 10 pages or so. And My Life is almost like a novella. It's really long. And the characters in My Life that Will has taken are Miss Aiel, who's the young sort of firebrandy student-y type who wants to work with his hands and move out of his own class and be a labourer. And his employer, who's a sort of strange older painter called Radish. And in My Life, this Misail character in the Chekhov story, he marries someone and the marriage is a mistake. And Will slightly adapted that in that he's actually taken the name, weirdly, of Misail's sister, Cleopatra, and given it to the fiancé, Cleopatra, who's called Cleopatra in this play. And we don't get to see that the marriage ends in failure with actually the woman leaving poor Misail. We just see that we can predict that that's what's going to happen because they're so obviously ill-matched. So that's my life. Oh, and Misail's father-in-law is a railway engineer, a sort of tycoon called Dolzhikov, who's a typical, like a Leparkin figure in the Cherry Orchard. And A Visit to Friends is a much, as I say, shorter story, but it for me, it's much more the meat of longing. And funnily enough, I found it quite hard to get hold of that story. So I read my life and I thought, well, where is Varya? Where is Kolya? Where are all those characters? And the answer is they're in A Visit to Friends.
Yeah. And yet A Visit to Friends is so small, but it's actually become the main event, hasn't it, really, in this play?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say that it's the major skeleton, you know, underneath the flesh of the play. And the story in that is Kolya, a very Chekhovian, sort of very Anton Chekhov type of a person, slightly commitment phobic, slightly outside the action, always slightly judging the people.
Oh, I love slightly commitment phobic. I don't think I've ever seen anyone on any stage anywhere more commitment phobic than Kolya.
Well, yes, you are right, I suppose. Yeah, well, Kolya goes to visit his friends, and they are rather like the family in the Cherry Orchard in that they have this estate, and Sergei, the husband, has married Tanya and has frittered away her money, and the estate must be sold at the point that they write to Kolya. And Varya is her oldest friend, and they write to him saying, come and visit, and it's a sort of light, airy letter, but he senses there's something going on, and he comes to visit. And Chekhov's brilliant at all the ambiguous feelings that Kolya feels. He slightly feels, oh, I remember, you know, 10 years ago I used to have such fun with these people. Now we're all a bit older, a bit fatter, and they have children and things. But, you know, I'd like to go and sort of nostalgically revisit that place. But he also senses that he's slightly possibly being used because they have a problem, and that's why they've got in touch with him. And when he turns up, the younger sister of Tanya has sort of blossomed into a beautiful young girl, and he senses that she fancies him and that they would all love it if he got together with her because it would, apart from anything, help them out financially. And he feels like he will, and then he feels like he doesn't want to, and he can't explain why. And Chekhov's brilliant at sort of outlining his feelings that he can't even really explain to himself. So in the play, all of this is more or less the same. And Will pushes it a little bit further so that, you know, Varya... Oh, yeah, I forgot to say the most important thing, that Varya in the story... Well, there's a tiny, tiny hint that there might have been something between her and Kolya. And Will goes further with that, and he makes that really the heart of the play.
And Varya is the Townsend Greg character, of course.
Yeah,
and Kolya wonderfully played by Ian Glen, so I wanted to box his ears by the end.
Yes, they're brilliant together, yeah.
I've been lucky to get a copy of the script, which is incredibly dangerous because you start wanting to quote it all over the place. But he's got a ring, hasn't he, Kolya? And Natasha notices that it says all things pass on it. And what he says is just, I think it's devastating, really, don't you? Do you want to read it?
Yes, he says, she asks him, why do you have this written on your ring, all things pass? And he says, because when I'm sad, these words make me cheerful. And when I'm cheerful and happy, they make me sad. All things pass, life will pass. You need nothing, Natasha. All you need is the feeling of freedom. For when someone is free, he or she needs nothing, nothing, nothing. I'm free, Natasha, you're free. Don't waste your tears on this house, on these woods and fields. All things pass.
Sounds like the Bible, doesn't it? All is vanity.
Yes,
but it's quite depressing.
Yes, well, interestingly, that is taken from my life. And, you know, it's funny how Will, like a magpie, has sort of taken one gem from one bit and put it in a sort of nest somewhere else, because that is in a letter that Misail's fiancé writes to him and says, set me free, I want to leave you. And she has this written on her ring. So it's interesting how it's transmuted when the way Will's used it, but it does put the hairs up on your arms, doesn't it, that what he says to her. And And she, I love that scene because she hears those words and something in her slightly dies when she hears that. She's hoping that he's going to give her the ring and say, will you marry me? And instead it's all things pass, you know.
She's far too young to be thinking of all things passing. You know, that's an old man's thought, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then the other one was, you know, Varya is still waiting for her kiss, I think. She says he must be fighting off women. And again, it's him again, isn't it? Happiness. He couldn't take it if it was offered to him. And we know this, don't we? And Varya sort of goes along with it.
Yes. He says, happiness. Why does everyone talk about happiness? What does it mean? After happiness comes unhappiness. After youth comes old age. Nobody can be healthy and cheerful all their lives. You have to be ready for anything. You have to work. You have to endure. You have to do your duty as best you can. And she says, that's a bit harsh, isn't it? A bit bleak. And he says, you're a doctor. You see life as it's really lived. Tell me I'm wrong.
And that's really how their relationship proceeds, isn't it?
Yes. He won't accept the possibility of happiness with somebody. It's frightening to him.
And so doing that, I think he blights her possibilities as well, doesn't he?
Yes, that's a very interesting scene because she says to him, take it, you know, you're a fool. If happiness is offered to you, especially on a plate, you should take it. And Tamsin was saying she's talking about herself too, you know, that they both had this opportunity of happiness together 10 years ago and they both let it go by and it shouldn't happen again, you know.
Tamsin's character is a doctor. I think that's really important, isn't it? She's a working woman. She's not just someone who's sort of drifting about. She is in the area to fight a cholera epidemic that's died down. And that's in the Chekhov?
Yes, she's a doctor in the Chekhov, although they don't talk much about it. And it's not really made a fuss of, because some people were saying, oh, is it really unusual for a woman to be a doctor? And, of course, we researched it, and it was fairly unusual, but it was beginning to happen because they just needed the people. And, you know, there's a wonderful photo that we found of a load of female medical students. And also what's fascinating is that because of the cholera epidemic, the peasants were incredibly suspicious that the doctors were actually trying to kill them. So there were lynchings and doctors were murdered. So at the top of the play, when Varya says, oh, my cholera is the least of it, my dear. If you could see some of the things. And then Tanya cuts her off and says, no, I don't want to hear about it. Well, that's what we're thinking of it there, is that, you know, there were these awful things that were happening to doctors. And I think it's interesting for her character that she had the self-confidence to go off and do that and not just sit about and be a debutante, you know.
Considering that Chekhov's a man and William's a man, I do think they have written very well about the sisterhood. I mean, the women do support each other in this play. I'm not so much thinking Cleopatra, but I'm obviously thinking of Varya, Tamsin's character, and Tanya, the very wronged wife whose estate has been frittered away by her feckless husband. So that was Natasha Little, and her younger sister, Natasha, the one that they're trying to set up to marry Collier, played by Eve Ponsonby. This was a fantastic trio of performances, you know, because they were so supportive of each other. Obviously, that's in the play, but it came over beautifully, I thought.
Yes, it's funny. Tamsin said to Will, he happened to come in one day when we were rehearsing the scene between those three women, and Tamsin turned to him and said, very sort of gravely, you honour women. And Will sort of didn't quite know what to say, I think, to that. But I think that he writes them really well, and those were some of my favourite scenes, actually. And the thing that really I loved about the play was this character of Varya. So, you know, I do love the way that he's written these rather unhappy women. And with these actresses, well, Natasha Little is brilliantly real, I think. She never does anything that's stagey. If anything, I have to push her to sort of be big enough to fill, you know, that space. But it's always, always detailed and real. And that, I love that about her. And Eve Ponsonby, who plays Natasha, the youngest, is amazing because we met so many girls for that part. And there's something a little bit actressy about a lot of young actresses who come in and they just sort of, they do an idea of what they think Chekhov is. And Eve just came in and read, and she really looked very ordinary when she came into the room, and I think she was wearing drain pipe jeans, and, you know, she wasn't wearing a sort of full skirt, which some of the girls wore when they came in. And then she just started reading, and it was like a light bulb just turned on, you know. She was brilliant. And, in fact, I think every woman in this show is brilliant. Catherine, who plays Cleopatra.
Catherine Stewart.
Oh, yeah, she's wonderful. I mean, a friend of mine, an actress who saw the show, said, I love her because, you know, her wants are so... She played her wants, you know, and she's not afraid to be vulgar, Catherine, and yet it's not. I don't think it's a crude performance at all. She's so delicate and pretty and young that it's sort of a great combination with someone who has the hide of a rhino at the same time. And I also love, I don't know if you noticed, but Mary Roscoe, who plays our serving maid Olga, and and the secretary at the end of the play. I mean, I love what she does with her performance, because these are tiny on the page, they really are nothing. And, you know, I tried to sort of talk to Will about adding some lines, actually, when we got Mary. You know, I said, she's so good, we ought to have more for her to do, and there simply wasn't the space in the play. But I love the fact that Mary gets there's a little narrative. She's worked it all out. You know, Olga is married to someone who works on the nearby farm, and her daughter is one of the other serving maids, and they've talked about that. You know, the whole sort of network and history that she's worked out for herself, you know, and it shows. You can sort of tell that there's that depth.
Yes, and if the steak goes down the pan, she may be at risk. That's what I got from it.
Oh, yes, yes. So that, you know, it matters even to her that that the master of the house is drinking all the money away in Madeira. Yeah.
I really noticed that, actually. Yes, absolutely, 100%. And perhaps we should just go through the rest of the cast, because this is John Sessions' return to the stage. I can't pronounce the name. Dolzhikov, have I got that right?
Yeah, Dolzhikov, yeah.
He's even got the Scottish accent, because he's supposed to be from the provinces, isn't he? And he's just really bluff and really nouveau, isn't he? To a fault, but very funny.
Yes, I think John is brilliant in this part. And the casting of John really, I suppose, came about because he's a friend of Will's, and he's been wanting to get on stage. And he had taken a big long break from it because of stage fright, I think, and other factors, like he was getting work in films and things. But, you know, he had stayed away from stage. So this is the first time he's been on stage for about 18 years or something. So, you know, it was amazing to see him. On the first preview, I just felt something really extraordinary when he came out, that the audience just responded to him. And I don't know whether it was John Sessions that they responded to, or the character, or both, but there's something about him in that part that people love. Everyone is rather sort of, they're stuck, these people in this play, and he isn't. He's going and doing what he wants, and he's hilarious and vulgar and touchy, and John does all of that brilliantly, you know. And there's also something I have to say about the fact that John gets very nervous that makes his performance incredibly alive.
Well, also, I suppose he's not at ease with all of these people around him because of that being nouveau riche. So that's how that translates, I think. I thought William Postlethwaite made a great fist of missile. He was really good. You know, the sort of angry young quasi-revolutionary from a rich family. He's going to work as a humble roofer or on the estate. And he's got this marvellous boss, isn't it? Radish, he's working with a peasant, which is obviously not what his dad wants. And that's Tom Georgeson. What an amazing pair they make, you know, in this other story. And Tom Georgeson spends so much time listening to other people, eavesdropping. You know, it's just fantastic. It's there in the writing, it's there in your direction, and, of course, the set enables all that sort of thing to happen.
Yes. Mm. Oh, God, that was a challenge because, you know, they are meant to be up on this roof the whole time. And Lizzie, of course, the designer, was obsessing about, well, they're up there for a lot of the time. And I was thinking, well, they're not, I mean, you know, because I forget, of course, that they're not speaking a lot of the time, but they are still up there. And Billy has a great look apart from anything else. I love the fact that he's so gawky and he has a great face. And he's got the youth, which just is funny. Again, that's a character that the audience find incredibly funny. And it's something about, you know, he hardly has to say anything, but they know already, oh, they can see what he is, you know. I adore Tom Georgeson. I think he's such a brilliant actor. I saw him in Frozen, I remember I thought he was absolutely brilliant as the murdering paedophile, actually, in that. And I also saw him in Dealer's Choice, and I loved him from A Fish Called Wanda. So I've been stalking him for years. And when we were casting it, in fact, the description of the character says 50s, you know, 50s that he's meant to be in. But I always had Tom in my head when I read it, because Radish, if you read the Chekhov short story, is a very strange character. And I thought Tom Georgeson has that otherworldly slight weirdness that's, you know, he's really interesting before he even opens his mouth, Tom Georgeson. So I wanted Tom in it, even though he's 75, you know, and he has to go up and down a ladder, and he's also slightly deaf, Tom, so, you know, he has to hear cues from up on a roof. But I'm so glad that we managed to get him in this part, because I just feel that he brings something absolutely brilliant. And when he started growing a beard immediately, and his hair, and when he parts his hair on the side, I mean, he could be one of those photos. We were looking at photos of old black and white photos of peasants. He looks exactly the part.
Did you all do research together, cast and creatives? Did you do a lot of research?
Yeah, well, the research starts always before, you know, rehearsals begin, because you want a bit of a head start and you're doing it for the set and things. But then I think it's really important. I remember ages ago I assisted Katie Mitchell, and I remember that she used to set aside, it felt like, I mean, this was a long time ago, but it felt like a half of each day was actors coming in and sort of ferrying in their bits of research that they'd been parceled off to do. I remember when we did Mountain Language, this Pinter play, and, you know, Danny Sequeira had to go off and research Turkish prisons and torture and stuff, and then he'd come in and sort of say, well, you know, this, that, the other, and everyone would listen. And it's a really good way of getting people completely absorbed in the world. So we did a bit of that. I remember I said to Alan Cox, could he research the estate? Because, of course, you try to pick things that are fitting for the character. I asked Billy to look at the politics of the time and to look at Tolstoyan thinking, which was fashionable, and what this character is sort of following and so on.
I'm loving all this, actually, because I did want to talk about Alan Cox's surgery. If I was annoyed and wanted to give a kick up the butt to Collier, I don't know what I felt towards Sergei, who is so astonishingly irritating. I mean, he is supposed to be irritating his wife. He keeps speaking in really affected little French phrases. He's obviously frittered all this money away. He's been to whorehouses. He really is. I mean, there's not, I don't think there's a redeeming feature about him, but he's actually very funny as well, as hugely irritating. So again, and that's a sort of towering performance from Alan Cox, because it's a very generous performance, I think. So there are all these figures in the play that are just wanting in all different ways, aren't there? And mostly the men, maybe, apart from Cleopatra. But what do you think about that, that, you know, that there are all these sort of people that leave something to be desired, so much to be desired?
Yeah, well, we were trying to analyse this as the, you know, with the cast, and I was thinking the play sort of divides into people who stand back and don't take what they want and try, you know, they sort of say after you, they're the after youers of this life. And then there are people who elbow people aside and say, I'm having that, thank you very much. And I feel that that's sort of what the division that happens in the play, so that Cleopatra sees a bloke that she wants and she says, well, I can see you're a bit sort of uncertain about marrying me, but I'm going to make you marry me. And then, you know, you play that off against Misail, who, you know, he's falling in love with Natasha, actually, the more soulful girl, but he can't, he's too unconfident to just take what he wants. And that was part of our sort of rehearsals, was I said, let's all think of times that we've watched the train leave the station, you know, and thought, oh, I've missed that train. And then the train comes back in and we think, oh, I could catch it. No, I won't. You know, one of the times in our lives that we've done this, we've sort of let opportunities pass, you know. And I think the other thing that the play is about a little bit is people demanding things they shouldn't demand, slightly, because when you think about it, you know, everyone in the play, they're all wanting things from Collier. They want him to kiss them, they want him to marry them, they want him to help them out, you know. And I thought that was an interesting thing as well. These people who take things in life, you know, when you are on the receiving end of it, how it feels when someone says, I want to borrow that dress, can I? And you sort of say, yes, all right, then, thinking, oh, but you stretched it last time or whatever. You know, if you find little things like that, that's what the actors and I sort of experimented with, was just to make it real to ourselves, you know.
Yeah, no, I love the idea of that, because obviously, as I said, I'm quite wanting to slap Collier for not taking his chances, because, you know, there's clearly been this failure to connect with Vario, which is Tamsin's character, that's gone back over decades, really. And you can see it all there, partly spoken, but an awful lot of it unspoken. But now you're sort of giving him his raison d'etre, his excuses, aren't you?
I suppose I am, because you've got to, it's a bit like an actor, you have to come at the part, you know, without judging it, really. And people say, oh, why is he such a commitment phobe? Well, I understand it, actually. I mean, I understand it more when you think of it as Anton Chekhov, actually, because if you're a writer, you've got this all-absorbing thing that's driving you, and you want to kind of go off and write another play, really. And of course, you're a human being, and you feel like you want to have sex and you want to connect with women, but then you want to, you're ultimately a kind of a person who, a lot of your energies is going into driving yourself to write. And so I sort of see Collier a little bit like Chekhov, and that's what Will thinks as well, is that the characters are very close. Mm. So the thing is that Collier's not a writer, he's a lawyer. Mm. So that's where the sort of similarity sort of peels away a little bit, I suppose.
Yeah, because you don't think of lawyers as being, you know, there's a huge creative in the same way, and needing to be alone with their creativity.
No, exactly. So that's where I suppose it might be a little bit more obscure as to why he won't connect. But I still think come on, there are so many men around us. I've met a few, you know, who, it's not that they don't want to sort of have some fun or go out with you. There's something in them that's fearful of the kind of self-annihilation that they see in actually committing to somebody and merging with them, you know, that there's a loss of self that might happen if they do that.
So in relation to the way you are when someone else is directing one of your plays, how was William Boyd with you? What sort of relationship did you have, and how far did it go back before you started rehearsal? What was it like during rehearsal? All those sorts of things.
Well, I mean, the story with Will is a really long one, because he's actually a friend of my father's because of the literary connection. And so I've sort of known of Will since I was a little girl. But this relationship, professional relationship, started a while ago when Longing had a reading at the National Theatre Studio, and my father went to see it, and he said, oh, you must read this script. And he gave me the script. This was a while ago, you know, I was just starting out, really. And I wrote Will a bit of a fan letter saying, I love this play, you know. And I think he was sort of thinking, right, I didn't even know you directed. I was just, you know, beginning. And then I said, if you ever want anyone to do it, you know, I'd love to do it. And then years and years later, you know, he's a busy man. It sort of got shelved by the National, and it sort of, I don't know, drifted around a bit. And then he wrote to me and said, are you still up for this? And I said, absolutely. And then the relationship, Will is amazingly laid back, you know, compared to, when I compare him to myself, you know, when poor Roger Michelle was casting Tribes, I had all sorts of opinions on who was right and who was wrong and why. And Will didn't even come to auditions. I mean, I think that Will, because he's coming from film and TV, maybe that's what it's like. Maybe the writer doesn't go so much to them. So he was incredibly hands-off for a playwright. And then the normal way of things would be to have the writer very much there in the first 2 weeks, and then maybe let them go off so that the actors can sort of relax a bit and just sort of say, I hate this scene, or whatever they want to say that they can't say when the writer's around. And with Will, I had to sort of really say, Will, will you come in? You know, will you? I think they'd like it if you were in. I mean, I think it's partly that he's just so busy as well. You know, he was doing all this Bond stuff at the time. And he came in on the first day, then he had a few days off, then he came in for a morning. I think he said he also found it that it's oddly draining. So I think he found that he could just do a half a day and then he would sort of go off. But he came to see most of the dress rehearsals and all of the previews, you know. So he got more and more sort of wound in, you know. And as for working with him, I mean, I just loved it because he's really, really encouraging and really unbitchy and intelligent and pragmatic and, you know, down to earth and not sort of precious or tantrumy or anything like that. For someone who's so well known and so respected and admired, he's got no ego whatsoever, and that is really refreshing. I mean, it's a bit like Tom Stoppard, another very, very nice guy who has seemingly very little ego. And you think, well, if you can be like this, why can't everybody, you know?
Well, that sort of almost neatly brought me back to your family. And I wonder, you know, but we know that actors are dynastic. I think writers are dynastic as well. I know it's not the whole family, but you've got such a fantastic background with your father being Craig Raine. And you're telling me about your brother has written a play as well, so it obviously seems to be, you almost can't help doing it by the sound of it. And your mother, Anne Pasternak Slater, there's a clue there in the name, because she's the niece of Boris Pasternak and you're the great-niece, is that right?
That's right, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So what's your take on that? Because I gather that your father's father wasn't anything like a writer at all, but an amazing character, but not a writer. So how's it been? I mean, do you think you just couldn't help writing?
No, I mean, I think that there's plenty of discouragement if you've got a very brilliant, gifted writer as a parent, you know, that it's quite scary. And that's probably why I've never tried to write poetry, because I just wouldn't dream of entering into the competition, really. But I suppose that maybe the playwriting might have come from, as a poet, my dad did opera, and he did a version of Racine's Andromaque that was on at the Almeida that Patrick Marber directed. And I remember that was when I was at university, and it seemed impossibly cool, you know. And
I love that cool.
So, you know, you think, oh, that looks like a great world to be in. Wouldn't that be amazing? And so I suppose, yes, it is inspiring in a way that the poetry was just simply intimidating, you know. Mm. And in a way, I can see why Moses, my brother, has become a playwright too. I mean, my dad is a poet, and he's so flamboyant, and he comes into a room and he dominates it and is entertaining. And as a playwright, you can sit back and listen and sort of absorb like a sponge. And that's certainly what Mo, my brother, does. He can be very quiet in a social gathering, you know. And then you sort of pick stuff up and you spin it out into your characters, and you can hide behind your characters. You feel that no one will ever be able to pin you down and say, well, that's what you think then. In that way, it's much less terrifying than writing prose, where you sort of feel you've got to say what you think. I mean, like, you know, I always used to read Tolstoy and think, how can he have that confident tone? And when he says, this is what he felt, and he felt it because of this, you know, I just think it's brilliant, but I wouldn't begin to know how to do that myself, you know.
You sound like you're saying, well, you know, being a playwright's the easy option. I think that's wonderful. I don't think that's really right. But so what did your parents make of you and Mo then?
Well, it's lovely. It's exciting for them to go to plays, and they're incredibly, when I look at other people's parents, I realise that they are very honest, my parents. So they're very brutal, actually, if something doesn't work. My mother simply can't lie, you know, and so she'll just say in a rather confused way, I didn't understand why, you know, why it seemed so bad or whatever. And you think, oh my God, you know. But that is brilliant, I think. It helps you sort of get better and so they're very supportive, but they are very honest, and I wouldn't want it any other way, really.
Nina Raine, thank you very much for talking to me for Theatre Voice.